I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. So Ladette O'Brien is on the program today. The CNN special correspondent will help kick off our coverage of the fifth anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. Her new documentary airs tomorrow. Also, the Barbershop Guys are with us with plenty on the perception of nearly one in five Americans that President Obama is a Muslim, the false perception, I should say. We'll hear more about what they have to say about that. But first, the politically and emotionally charged question of the construction of a new mosque. And no, we are not talking about that cultural center proposed for Lower Manhattan near Ground Zero. We're talking about Murfreesboro, Tennessee. That's about 40 minutes outside of Nashville. It's one of a number of proposed mosque sites across the country that is facing resistance. In Murfreesboro, the facility could be as large as 52,000 square feet, and the region is becoming more and more divided. Local TV news viewers on WSMV and WTVF heard these and other voices of opposition.
Who is behind the mosque? Why is it here? Right? And why is it so big?
This mosque that they're trying to build, all it is a training center. In Islam, a mosque means we have conquered this country. And where are they? In the center of Tennessee. They're going to say, we have conquered Tennessee.
Do you forget 9/11 so fast? It seems like the American people do.
The size of the building means something. It is a very large building, and it's supposed to have only 200 memberships, and I don't want anybody in there creating something that can be used to attack us.
So as you heard, questions have been raised. So we decided to answer those questions. So we've called Saleh Spinati. He is a member of the planning committee for the proposed Islamic Center. He's a longtime Tennessee resident. He's been living in Murfreesboro for 18 years. He's also a professor of computer engineering technology at Middle Tennessee State University. And he's with us now. And welcome. And thank you for joining us.
Thank you. And thank you for hosting me.
So let's just ask the questions that some of these folks have been asking. And let's assume that these aren't the only voices that one could hear, but these are some voices who obviously have some very strong feelings about this. So why is this proposed building so big?
That's a really good question, but let me make one point very clear. We're not going to build 52,000 square foot mosque or facility. What we presented to the commissioners at Rutherford County is our vision for the future. And what we are going to start with is phase number one. Phase number one is about 10,000 square foot. That's including a 4,500 square foot multipurpose room that can be used for holding prayers like the Friday prayer, and then holding also social events. For example, like in Ramadan, the fasting month of Ramadan, we have dinners for the community. And also we are going to host a dinner for the non-Muslim also.
So just to clarify, where you're praying now, it's like two business suites, and you separate by gender during prayer, right, customarily?
Now, I mean, you know, they have to be in a different location altogether because, you know, the place would not be accommodating for men.
No, I understand. I'm just clarifying what the situation is now. And you're saying that the people in the congregation, there are what, about 200 families, 200, 250 families?
We estimate about 250 families. You know, you need to keep in mind that family probably including four or five members, you know, kids and so on. And then we have a growing Muslim student in the university. Many students are basically practicing Muslims, and that's in addition to those 250 families.
Okay, so let me just ask you, you've lived in the community for almost 20 years. Are you surprised by the response that you're getting to this, to the proposed new facility?
We are extremely surprised, actually, because, you know, the 30 years, almost 30 years that I've been in Tennessee, I haven't had any issues about my religion. People respect me and I respect them. My kids grew up here and, you know, their friends, actually, we know their families and so on. So we were really surprised, and we did not have any indication before we put the sign on our new property. And then the first indication was a vandalism to the sign, you know, wrote on the sign, not welcome. And then later on, you know, they broke the sign totally. And then after getting the approval, actually, we applied like anybody else for our permit. And after we get the approval, actually, people, you know, started to rally against this project.
I'm just wondering if you don't mind my asking, after 9/11, there were some people who experienced some negative reaction in some parts of the country. Did any of that happen to you?
Yeah, let me tell you, Michelle, it was really heartwarming, actually, after 9/11, even though 9/11, it was really a tragic, tragic day that I would never forget to the end of my life. It would be surprising to walk on the days after 9/11, and my wife put a scarf on her head, and she's known to be a Muslim, right? So people who we don't know, we would be walking in a grocery store and people would come to us and tell us, please do not feel afraid. You know, we know that your religion has nothing to do with this. This is just terrorism, and, you know, we don't want you to feel afraid or scared. So that's why, you know, we were really surprised with this, you know, wave of attacks against Muslim and Islam in general, because we have not anticipated anything like that.
You never had this before. This is very interesting. No. Well, what do you attribute it to? What do you think is going on here?
I think this is a nationwide going opposition, and I think there are forces inside our county and city that probably moved because of someone from outside motivated the resident here.
Like who?
When you hear comments by so-called leaders who try to probably bash Islam to attract what they think, you know, the conservatives or, you know, people who might have some concern about Islam.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin, and we're talking about the opposition to a mosque being built not in Lower Manhattan, but in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. And I'm speaking with Professor Saleh Spinati, who is a member of the planning committee for the Murfreesboro Islamic Center. He's a longtime member of that community, and he's talking to us about how the plans to build the mosque have been received. What about this whole thing about I don't want anybody in there creating something that could be used to attack us. And let me ask, the reason I'm asking this is that there have been a number of high-profile incidents. There was the Major Nidal Hassan, who was the Army psychiatrist who killed and wounded a number of people at Fort Hood before being shot himself. And a lot of people look at that example and they think that he sought out religious institutions where he was validated in these beliefs, and they are concerned.
Well, let me say first that there are crazy people in every society, in every religion, in every way you go. This is the nature of a human being. This is an unfortunate, event, and we understand that. But, for example, you know, the Islamic Center of Murfreesboro is completely open, and we have, we have made ourselves and our facility completely open to the inspection of anyone. We have many non-Muslims who participated and came to our Friday prayer. We actually used to broadcast our Friday prayer sermon on our website, and you know, everything is open to the public.
I see your point, but can I just ask you though? I on this, just if I may, just press you on the question. There have been some mosques that have, for whatever reason, become a center for people who have become radicalized, and they have experienced validation there. In some cases, maybe they sought out that validation there. That was not the intention of the people who built those institutions. That may not be the attitude of the majority of the people worshiping at those institutions. But for whatever reason, there have been places that have become a magnet for individuals who then adopt a very specific worldview that then leads them to wish to do harm to Americans, and that people are afraid. So what would you say to people who say that they have that fear? What are you going to do to see that that doesn't happen?
I understand this fear, and I want to emphasize, you know, the majority of our congregation, the majority is U.S. citizens who have been here for a long time, who want to live here for a long time. I had, after 9/11, I was interviewed by federal officials, and they basically, you know, they were concerned about our community in general and about our safety also, and I really thank them for coming. And I would tell them straight, you know, I would tell them, if I see anything that is going to harm this country, I'm going to be the first to report it. Our imam said that to everyone. everybody has an open eye to whatever goes on. Everything goes, for example, in terms of curriculum that we teach, in terms of the books that we have in the mosque, in terms of who we elect, for example, for the board members and so on. Everybody is checked extremely, extremely under the microscope to make sure that, you know, there's no hidden agenda, there is no political attachment, there is no political affiliation, nothing. So, you know, I can give you this assurance, you know, that everybody would actually come forward and say if there is any suspicious activities. But
you think it'll go forward? You think the mosque will go forward? It is already, it's already been approved.
Right. We're doing everything according according to the law and according to the books. So, you know, we're going forward with the plan and with the construction, and hopefully we will let our community celebrate with us, and we are going to invite everybody, and we are going to make an open house as soon as we get the facility built. This is something that we are going to be proud of. The community is going to be proud of. Murfreesboro and Rutherford County and Tennessee in general is going to be proud of. So we are going to go forward.
Saleh Spinati is a member of the planning committee for the proposed Murfreesboro Islamic Center. He's also a professor of computer engineering technology at Middle Tennessee State University. And as he told us, he's lived in Tennessee for 30 years, and he's with us from Franklin, Tennessee. Thank you so much for speaking with us, Professor.
It's my pleasure. Great to be here.
I should mention that this is just the latest conversation we've had on this topic, which is, as we've said, highly charged. If you want to check out previous conversations, including one with civic engagement leader Rich Harwood about how communities can resolve difficult topics like this, or with two Muslim Americans who oppose the Manhattan Islamic Center site, please check out the Tell Me More programs page at npr.org. Next, CNN special correspondent Soledad O'Brien went back to Louisiana to revisit survivors in one historic black community 5 years after Hurricane Katrina. She's coming up on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. I'm Michelle Martin, and you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. In a few minutes, we hear from you in Back Talk, and we'll hear from CNN's Soledad O'Brien, who'll tell us about her new documentary about how one New Orleans community is trying to rise again. That's later. But first, for our Friday political chat, we thought we'd look into a study that takes on the interesting question of which political books are more likely to get the attention of influential decision makers. It's an article of faith that a review in the New York Times book review section is key, perhaps even make or break. The Times is the largest remaining Sunday book section and one of the few remaining stand-alone newspaper book review sections in the country. But according to a recent study by a liberal media watchdog group, the Times has, quote, an exceedingly narrow view of whose books deserve review and who is fit to discuss them, unquote. The group is Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, or FAIR, and they examined every politically themed book critiqued by the Times Review between January of 2009 and February of this year. The report said that 95% of the U.S. authors reviewed were white and 87% were male, and book reviewers were even less diverse. We wanted to know what that was all about, so we've called Christopher Lehman Haupt. He was an editor of the New York Times Book Review from 1965 to 1969. Then he was appointed senior daily book reviewer for the Times, handling those duties from 1969 until 2001. Now he's the editorial director for Delphinium Books, and he's with us now. Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So what's the chicken and what's the egg here in your view? Well, first, I think I want to ask you, were you surprised by these numbers?
Well, I was, but I felt as if I was looking at a pond in which the fish were feeding way over in one corner, and the conclusion was drawing, therefore, there are only fish there. You have to go deep into the pond to see what's really going on. And I should say that over the years, and I began work at the Times in 1965 and retired in 2006 and still appear occasionally, as I did yesterday with an obituary. but I'm speaking from the past. The Times has very aggressively sought to be diverse in every respect, culturally, ethnicity-wise, sex-wise. They don't like to use the word gender. And politically, and they have promoted women. They've promoted multicultural, the racial diversity, and even to the point of a fault, as was pointed out in a review by Russell Baker of a book by Gerald Boyd recently about the Jason Blair affair of some years ago.
Mm-hmm. I understand, which is his perspective on it, which is not universally shared. But just tell me your overall perspective on this. You said you have to look deeper into the pond. What are you saying? Are you saying that there's more diversity of non-political books?
I think that the Times, and I worked on the book review. I was an editor from 65 to 69 on the Sunday Book Review. We never, and I know that the Book Review has never had a grid in which they said, are we representing enough diversity in terms of race, sex, and political. The editor at the moment, Sam Tannenhaus, if anything, seeks to be surprising by linking right-wing reviewers with left-wing books and vice versa. That perhaps is conscious, but that's always the aim, is to find the most interesting books. They get, 50,000 books a year. They go through them. They are always conscious of the fact there are newspapers, so they respond to what seems politically important, what seems to be of interest to their readers. And that's how those choices are made. They're never made, are we representing,
So diversity is not a consideration, is what you're saying.
Diversity is not a consideration in the judgment of which books to review and who should review them.
What do you think about this whole question of the chicken and the egg here? Is it that people of color and women are not writing as many political books, that they have a harder time getting those books published, or that the book review simply isn't choosing those books? What do you think?
Well, I think that, again, you have to go a little bit deeper. Publishing has become is going through a real crisis now. The most obvious thing is that the so-called midlist book, the book that isn't going to be a bestseller, isn't being published to the degree that it was, say, in the 1960s, where there was a conscious effort to represent diverse views, races, and so forth. I think it reflects what's being published. Does the book review I don't know what's being published by smaller presses that might be publishing Latino writers, for example, African-American writers. But the major houses are simply doing less diverse books in every respect because they're aiming for the bestseller.
And forgive me for being so short on time for this interesting topic, but the question of reviewers is interesting as well, because that is something that the Times does control. I just happened to be looking at the Post in the Times front pages today. There are 5 front page stories on the Washington Post. 4 of them have bylines of women or people of color. There are 7 front page stories of the New York Times today. There's 1 female byline, and I am wondering, the whole question of who is chosen to review these books. Do you think that that's something that bears scrutiny or not?
I can speak more from more greater experience having to do with a daily book review, where from the first daily book reviewer in the 1920s, I believe, John Chamberlain, there are now the 2 major daily book reviewers are women, and the senior reviewer on the daily staff is a mm-hmm. woman, and that has been a very conscious attempt by the
All
Times.
Right. All right. We'll have to leave it there for now. Thank you for your insights. We do appreciate it. Christopher Lehman Haupt is a former editor of the New York Times Book Review, a former senior daily book reviewer for the Times. He continues to contribute to the Times, as he told us. He's now editorial director for Delphinium Books, and he joined us from our bureau in New York. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Next Sunday marks 5 years since Hurricane Katrina made landfall as a Category 5 hurricane. At least 1,800 people died from the effects of the storm, and the lives of so many more were drastically changed. CNN special correspondent Soledad O'Brien covered Katrina. She's covered the aftermath, and she was just back to report on one community with a long historic tie to New Orleans. Pontchartrain Park, a middle-class black community, was one of the hardest hit by Katrina, and Soledad O'Brien documented its journey in a documentary titled New Orleans Rising, and Soledad joins us now from CNN New York. Soledad, thanks so much for joining us once
it's
again.
It's always my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So why did you decide to focus on this particular community?
We looked at a lot of communities, and the question we were trying to answer was, so how's New Orleans now? Because that's what I'm asked all the time, pretty much wherever I go. And what I liked about the focus on Pontchartrain Park was its history. Pontchartrain Park was the first place that African Americans could buy a home in the 1950s. So it has this amazing history, and it also has this amazing hero, Wendell Pierce, the actor, you know him from The Wire and Tremé, who became this kind of accidental developer when he stepped forward to help people who wanted to return, like his parents and like other elderly people in the community. He stepped forward to kind of coalesce all this energy around, can we do it? Because even though, as you point out, and we point out in the documentary, still only a third of the people had returned. So it's a real struggle for a community that should be one of the best situated to return financially and otherwise.
Well, I want to hear a little bit more about why it's been so difficult. But first, I want to just play a short clip from the documentary from one of the interviews you did with Wendell Pierce. I must say, a lot of people know that he's a New Orleans native, but I don't think I knew until I saw your film just what an active role he has been playing in the reconstruction of that area. Let's just play a short clip. Here it is.
Pontchartrain Park. It is a labor of love. It is my community, it's my home, and I would do every and anything to make sure it's restored. I need to rebuild, because we are a family. Nothing counts so much as family.
But as you point out in the documentary, not everybody is as excited about rebuilding and moving back as Wendell Pierce is. Here is an interview you did with the wife of one of Wendell's childhood friends, Lisa Oubre.
If I were to go and look at Wendell's wonderful new home, it's almost like a home that's now been built over, you know, a battlefield. That's what it feels like. You know that something so bad has happened here, and you have this wonderful home that's now built over all of this sadness and so much pain and loss. I can't reconcile the two.
Is that a common feeling?
I know so many people like Lisa Oubre. It's terrible. Maybe they're not fighting with their spouse about moving back. Maybe it's a mother-daughter, maybe it's siblings who say, you know, one person says, I just can't do it. I just cannot bring myself. Lisa Oubre has moved on. She moved to Baton Rouge, moved in with family members in kind of a makeshift situation, lots of people living in one house, but she's a manager at the Home Depot. You know, she's moved her life on, and she says, you know, the way I can heal is to get my life on track in a new direction. The way that her husband, Herbie Oubre, moves on is to try to figure out how to rebuild in Pontchartrain Park. And those are obviously two trains going two opposite directions. And it's so sad because when you sit down and talk to them, they clearly like each other and love each other, but this issue is ripping them apart. And I cannot tell you the number of people I know who will say, you know, my parents called and say, should I move back? And I have to say, I don't know. I don't know. You should, maybe you shouldn't. That to me was sort of a very consistent theme in whatever neighborhood you were from in New Orleans.
But to that point, though, there has been a discrepancy between the pace at which other communities have rebuilt and this historically black community. And as you point out, this is a community that is 93% homeowners. Why is it that this community, which was almost as hard hit as Ward 9, but hasn't seen as much support and doesn't seem to be able to rally as quickly. Were you
Absolutely.
Able to figure that out?
That was our question, you know, and my question was, so is this race or is this something else? And it turns out the answer is more something else. Pontchartrain Park is a community of elderly people, and that at its core was the problem. People who were in their 80s, some of them just couldn't really take moving back. So what Wendell's trying to do is to say, great, let's renovate these homes and move younger people into Pontchartrain Park. It should not fall to the hands of developers. But as Wendell Pierce likes to say, not everyone has your best interests at heart. And I'd say, well, what does that mean? Are you saying it's racism? Are you saying it's discrimination? Are you saying what? And I think that he felt, as he went through this process, that they were the people who had their own best interests at heart. So the community was going to buy up the homes and create a system in which they could bring people back, keep the profit, plow it back into the community, make a senior citizen's home, and save themselves.
Final question. It's a tough one. This was 5 years after Katrina. If you and I come back 5 years from now, what do you think we'll see?
Much better. I think it's a 10-year rebuilding program. So many people have said that to me. I think you've seen tons of progress, 80-some-odd percent, maybe 83% of the city's back. And some pockets are really slow. But for me, what is an indication of the good news is that people are fighting to do it. I mean, they've sort of given up on it's going to happen quickly and someone's going to come in, that someone from somewhere is going to come in and save us. I think just as in the immediate aftermath of the storm, there's no someone coming to save you. So get yourself together and save yourselves. And that's what Wendell, more than anything, is marketing. He says, you know, what the Pontchartrain Park Community Development Corporation, ourselves, are saving ourselves. And this can be a model for anyone who's in New Orleans or outside of New Orleans. Save yourselves. This is how to do it. That's really the message he wants to give.
Soledad O'Brien is CNN special correspondent. Her latest documentary, New Orleans Rising, premieres tomorrow on CNN and Soledad. We're also looking forward to your forthcoming memoir, which will be out later this fall. So
memoir sounds old, doesn't it? Don't you have to be like 90 to write a memoir? I consider it just a book.
Your latest book. We'll look forward to that. Soledad joined us from New York. Thanks, Soledad.
My pleasure.
And now it's time for Back Talk, where we lift the curtain on what's happening in the blogosphere and get a chance to hear from you, our Tell Me More listeners. Producer Lee Hill, our digital media guy, joins me here in the studio as usual. Hey, Lee, what's up?
Hey, Michelle. Well, I think it's fair to say this week's parenting conversation made a lot of jaws drop, and it definitely inspired people to get online and share their feedback. Tuesday, we talked to a group of moms who share a unique experience. They were mistaken for the nannies of their multiracial or simply different-looking children. Here's a clip from that conversation with featured mom Jamila Bay.
I am African-American. That's incredibly obvious, especially if you're looking at my hair. My husband is Caucasian. My son, he's got blonde hair and gray-blue eyes. I was in an elevator one day. He was in a stroller, and a woman looked at him and said, oh, so beautiful, so beautiful. Are you looking for more work? And she said, oh, well, you know, you're just so good with him. And when I realized what she was asking, it hurt.
And as you might imagine, in response to that conversation, we received quite a bit of feedback. Here's a note we received from listener Ingrid. She writes, I'm white. My husband is Ethiopian. Our three children are grown now, but when they were young, I was sometimes asked where I had gotten my children and complimented for having helped children in need.
Oh, me.
Oh, well, wow.
But other listeners, like Michael, had a different message. He writes, good God, people, toughen up. It's a hard world, and getting questioned if you are a nanny for a baby of a different color than you is hardly anything to get worked up over. He goes on to write, I'm white. My wife is black. Our child is also black. I have been questioned and could care less about what people think. Thank you, Michael. And continuing on the parenting theme, this week we talked about the rising popularity of sperm donation as a means for forming a family. And we spoke with one child who was conceived through sperm donation, and she talked about how she feels that experience has affected her life. Following that conversation, our producer Alicia Montgomery penned something for the Tell Me More blog about her decision to choose a sperm donor as a means of conceiving her child. Quite a few people also wrote to us about that. Here's a post from commenter Camila. She writes, I'm 30 years old and have not had much luck finding a loving husband, yet I believe experiencing motherhood is my destiny. If I don't get married in the next 5 years, I intend to have a family without a father. As long as my children will grow up in a household of love with plenty of family and friends to support and mentor them, I know they will turn out fine. I grew up without a father, and I grew into an educated, productive member of society. Thanks, Camila. Lee, what else?
Last week on the program, we discussed the celebrity buzz surrounding the war crimes trial of former Liberian leader Charles Taylor. Now, the case involves his alleged trading of so-called blood diamonds, and it stirred quite a frenzy when supermodel Naomi Campbell testified about diamonds she received. We learned that Jeremy Ratcliffe, head of former South African President Nelson Mandela's Children's Fund, confessed he's been in control of the diamonds since 1997. That's when Campbell gave them to him, she says, because she wanted them to go to charity. Well, yesterday, Ratcliffe resigned from his post and turned the gems over to South African police.
And Lee, we also have more news about Shirley Sherrod. She's the former USDA official who was forced to resign last month after her comments about overcoming racial prejudice were used out of context during the firestorm in which she lost her job. She was initially blasted by some in the media, her superiors at the Obama administration, and the NAACP. Well, this week, Sherrod officially made peace with the civil rights organization. In an open letter, she wrote, quote, that's behind us, and the last thing I want to see happen is for my situation to weaken support for the NAACP. Interesting.
Very interesting development.
Thank you, Lee.
Thanks, Michelle.
And remember, with Tell Me More, the conversation never ends. To weigh in with your own thoughts, you can call our comment line at 202-842-3522. Again, that's 202-842-3522. Please remember to leave your name. And you can also go to our website to read what other listeners are saying and to add your own comments. Log on to npr.org, click on Programs, then on Tell Me More, and blog it out. Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. It's time for our weekly visit to the barber shop, where the guys talk about what's in the news and what's on their minds. Sitting in the chairs for a shape-up this week are freelance writer Jimmy Israel, syndicated columnist, civil rights attorney, and editor Arsalan Iftikhar, Sports Illustrated reporter Pablo Torre, and syndicated columnist Ruben Navarrete. Take it away, Jimmy.
Hey, thanks, Michelle. Hide your kids. Hide your wife. It's the shop. What's good, fellas?
Hey.
I'm good, man.
You ain't right.
Good. All right, let's jump right into it.
What would it be like without the adult supervision that Michelle provides? That's what I want to know.
Thank you.
All right. You know what? President Obama is a Muslim. At least that's what 18% of Americans think, Michelle.
Yeah, I must tell you that this poll has been the buzz in Washington this week and probably elsewhere. And just to be clear, this survey, according to the Pew Research Center, was taken before the president weighed in on the whole question of whether Muslims had the right to build a community center a couple of blocks away from Ground Zero. Time magazine, by the way, has its own poll putting the number at 24%. And this is actually an increase from previous years, when there's always been a percentage of people who thought that. And the White House, there's an interesting story in the Post today where the White House points out that the president likes to keep his religious life as private as possible, felt a need to respond point by point to point out that the president is a Muslim. So that's it.
Wow. Well, Ruben, you know, A-Train, A-Train, I want to get you in here in a moment, but, you know, Ruben, out in San Diego— Listen, wouldn't all the rumors about President Obama being a Muslim be quashed if he was more open and forthcoming about his Christian faith, or does it even really matter?
I think it doesn't matter. I think that for people who are paying attention, they know that he has been open about his Christian faith. He's not like, you know, what's this mean, really? Bill Clinton used to walk out of a church with a Bible in his hand, okay? But what he did after hours, different thing, right? Different thing.
So, right.
What's that mean to be a good Christian? And oftentimes, when politicians are trying to project the idea of being a good Christian, you've got to be skeptical about that. And so, I think to come down on Obama's side about this, he's not doing anything wrong. The problem isn't Obama. The problem is people are coming to grips with the different, and he is different. He's different in every single way that you can imagine from previous presidents. Other than the fact that he's a male, right? We've only had male presidents, so in that regard, he's mainstream. But other than that, people are trying to deal with the difference, and this is just one way of separating him out and thinking of himself as – they think of him as not really American, not really patriotic, not really the same as everybody else, and he's different, and it's all wrapped up together.
You know what, ladies and gentlemen, mark today on your calendar, because the R and me, we agree. Because, you
Don't
know,
this that,
is
–
This is all about his detractors needing to underscore his otherness. Look, you know, so if it isn't about his being well educated, it's about the way he orders a hot dog using a certain kind of vernacular. And if it's not that, it's about where and how often he goes on vacation and on and on and on. The running meme is just Obama is not one of us. And it's troubling. A-Train.
Yeah, well, you know, for me, just the surreal absurdity of this all has just been one big whiskey tango foxtrot moment for me. I mean, I feel like every time, you know, people say that President Obama is a Muslim, that Jerry Seinfeld should pop out and say not that there's anything wrong with that.
Right.
You know, I mean,
right.
It's completely absurd, you know, to think, you know, when the whole Reverend Jeremiah Wright thing came out, he was this militant Christian black liberation theologist. And now, conveniently, you know, he happens to be a Muslim. Let's not forget, after he was elected, you know, for weeks, Rush Limbaugh on his, you know, syndicated radio show referred to him as President Hussein. You know, whenever they, you know, the whisper campaigns of Barack Hussein Obama being some sort of crypto-Muslim Manchurian candidate, you know, it really is pandering to the lowest common denominator in American society. And it took a Republican, General Colin Powell, former Secretary of State Colin Powell, to go and meet the press before the election to say, you know what? even if he was a Muslim, so what? And it was only then that the right-wingers, you know, stopped, you know, these campaigns. And so it's really just American politics at its worst again.
You know, there's an interesting piece on the Washington Post op-ed page today from Greg Sargent's blog on domestic politics. And he says that there's an interesting nugget buried in the poll's internals. It says that 60% of those who believe that Obama, who falsely and incorrectly believe that Obama is a Muslim, say they, quote unquote, learned it from the media. And so he's raising the question of what does this mean about our media culture? Is it that this, you know, we know that the cable sphere has and the blogosphere has become kind of polarized politically. So does it mean that there's such an alternate reality out there now that people think that anything they read from these outlets is true? Or he raises the question, is it that other media outlets haven't been aggressive enough in knocking down these kinds of rumors? So he raises a question about the media, along with the whole question of what should Obama himself be more public about his faith. You remember there was this big frenzy about which church he was going to go to.
Right.
It's my understanding that they as a family decided that there was just too much drama attached to that. There was just too much attention being paid to that. So they're worshiping privately at Camp David.
Right.
And Pablo,
which is what President Reagan did, I have to say.
Right.
Pablo, yeah. P-Dog, get it.
And so, I mean, yeah, I mean, I agree. There is a lot of misinformation. But as far as, like, what President Obama needs to do, I mean, this isn't, like, the highest of intellectual hurdles here. I mean, like, you can just sort of look it up on the internet and you sort of, oh, if you go to a reputable source, they'll probably tell you the right thing. And what it really just hints at, I mean, going back to the whole construction of the mosque and the cultural center thing, is this, to be very blunt, inherent distrust that still is very pervasive in American – in the American, you know, populace that, you know – being a Muslim is still a odd and scary thing, and they, you know, if President Obama is associating himself, he has this weird name. I mean, again, it's still like we're tripping over this very small hurdle here, a very short hurdle here, and it's troubling. I mean, the bottom line is, and this is hints at the reason why I think you don't turn to. I mean, obviously, it's not a majority of people, but the fact that so many people believe that. I mean, you need to apply sort of this intellectual rigor to all of these ideas, whether it's the fact that this mosque or cultural center is associated with extremist Muslims or the president is associated with extremist Muslims. I mean, it's just ridiculous. Right. And you don't take people's opinions and polls at face value without applying them to some sort of standard here.
Well, and did anyone think for a moment, you know, there are 7 million American Muslims, including myself, who live in this country today, who are patently offended by this dialogue because of the fact that it inherently insinuates that being a Muslim is some sort of slur, you know, as though, you know, President Obama having to say, oh, no, don't worry, I'm a Christian. We all know that to be a material fact. But, you know, the fact is, oh, you know, don't worry, I'm not one of them sort of thing. And you know, it does, you know, demonize, you know, a significant, you know, portion of the American populace. More importantly, we have two wars going on in two Muslim countries right now. We talk about, you know, the notion of why do they hate us? Well, this is one of the reasons that they hate us abroad.
Let me just jump in briefly, Ruben, to say if you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. We're having our weekly visit to the barbershop with Arsalan Iftikhar, Ruben Navarrete, Jimmy Israel, and Pablo Torre. Back to you, Ruben.
Well, you know, let me ask the question this way, Arsalan. All the folks out there, it's really got to be a tough spot to be a moderate Muslim, you know, in this kind of climate. But a lot of people seem to be saying that they want to hear more from moderate Muslims condemning the radical, extreme Islamic, you know, fanatics that we're at war with. And I hear that all the time in my community. Obviously, there are a lot of folks out there who want me and other Mexican Americans to constantly beat the idea that we're in favor of border security. So I don't fight it. I say I understand where that's coming from. And I want to ask you that same question. Do you think that moderate Muslims have brought some of this on themselves because they have not been more vocal condemning the extreme
elements? But what else should they say?
Hold on. Ruben, I'm just asking. I've spent 8 years, 10 months, however many days since the moment of September 11th, 2001 at 8:46 in the morning at Eastern Standard Time, spending the entirety of my life living and breathing 24/7 condemning every act of terrorism that has ever occurred from that day forward. And there have been thousands and thousands of Muslims who have gone to the airways and have dedicated our lives to doing it. Ruben, you have to admit, there are just some people in this country that we could stand on a corner with a bullhorn condemning terrorism for the rest of our life, and it still would not be enough. They want to paint things in an us versus them, black versus white mentality. And, you know, unless we, you know, dance the George Bush jig, you know, they're not going to be happy with anything that we do.
One other element, foreigner versus native. That's a really important distinction.
I was born in Norfolk, Virginia, man.
Exactly. This idea we talked about. we talked about Barack Obama and whether or not people think he's a Muslim. Don't forget, just a few days ago when we're still having this conversation about whether he was born in the United States, it's all part of this dialogue about somebody being different and foreign. And foreign is quickly thought to be, you know, unpatriotic, un-American, and inferior.
Speaking of your hometown, A-Train, Rod Blagojevich, oh snap, the ex-Illinois governor, Lord. Somehow he left his federal corruption trial virtually unscathed.
That's true.
He was up against 24 charges, but only convicted of one.
Poor Arsalan. First he's got to defend being Muslim, and now he's got to defend being from Chicago. Oh, that ain't right. That just isn't right.
This one is easy. This one is harder.
Not right.
Harder.
But you know, but anyway, Blagojevich surfaced today again, and prosecutors, of course, said that they're going to retry him, and he's not happy about that. He talked about that on the Today Show.
The very thing that they're trying to convict me of, political horse trading, and in this case it was merely discussing possibilities with lawyers, political advisors, and remember there were emissaries sent to me by the president himself, political horse trading, this is what they're trying to now criminalize. These prosecutors who act in a way where they're making deals with convicted felons, and in exchange for their testimony, these felons come in and say what these prosecutors want to say. The very thing they're charging me with, they ought to charge themselves with, and they ought to add an additional count of hypocrisy.
Wow. And all righty then.
Man.
Thanks, Michelle. You know what? I've always said this. You get the justice you can afford in America. I'm not surprised. You know, and I'm with the Washington Post. You know, their ed board this morning said, you know what? Back away. Don't try to retry this guy. I'm all about that. A-Train.
He'll beat you again.
Yeah, you know,
That's right. When
Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald initially announced the charges, you know, he went so far as to say that the gravity of the charges would make Abraham Lincoln roll in his grave. And apparently Abraham Lincoln didn't even sneeze in his grave because he was only convicted on one out of the 24 counts. And that was, you know, one of the lesser charges of lying to FBI agents. You know, the huge charges of bribery, racketeering, mail fraud. There was a hung jury. It was a mistrial. Now, granted, you know, on some of the major counts, there was an 11-1 vote. And so, you know, essentially, they might be able to get the 12-0 jury vote necessary to convict him in a retrial.
Let me just briefly jump in on just to defend Fitzgerald before we move on to the sports, which I know you want to talk about. And that Fitzgerald says that the reason that they called for arrested him without waiting to collect further evidence was that they felt that the seat would be tainted if they didn't. And, you know, you can argue with it, but because evidently the jury wanted to see, they wanted to see the evil deed actually done, something completed. And when they didn't see that, they weren't persuaded. But, you know, just to speak up for Fitzgerald, his argument was, look, this would have tainted this seat in perpetuity, and so we had to intervene before
then
that.
Then he blew it.
You could argue.
He blew it.
There you go. I'm just saying.
He was thinking like a politician and not a prosecutor.
Abe Lincoln ain't rolling.
All right. Before we go. Two very different stories involving two sports icons. The first is Major League Baseball pitcher Roger Clemens. He was indicted on 6 counts of lying to Congress under oath when he denied using performance-enhancing drugs. And the other, of course, is Brett Favre, who officially returned this week to play in his 20th season in the NFL. But I don't know, Pablo, you got to tell me about Roger Clemens. How serious a story is that?
Yeah, you know, it's not necessarily serious in that he's – I mean, on the merits of the case, he's one of countless players who use steroids, allegedly performance-enhancing drugs. And the reason why Roger Clemens is in this position is because he put himself there. I mean, this is a guy who, when he perjured himself, allegedly, you know, he had volunteered to go to the Mitchell Report hearing. He's the guy who said, I'm going to go to Congress and I'm going to clear my name because there are all these rumors out there. And then he said all this stuff. I mean, he's a guy who actually, in this world of players sort of skating on this and sort of fading into the background and letting their game speak for themselves, he's the guy who had the courage of his bizarre convictions to actually fight this thing till the end, put himself in the spotlight, and that's why he's having the force of the government come down upon him. Now, whether that's a good thing, whether that's a good use of public funds, I don't know, but all I can say is that Roger Clemens really just did the worst marketing job on himself as any athlete has done. Once the best pitcher maybe in baseball history, now one of these exaggerated cartoonish jokes, the Barry Bonds equivalent in many ways maybe even worse in terms of how vocal he's been.
Does this really, do you think, taint baseball, though, or is it because he's sort of old news? It doesn't really affect people's feelings about the game. That's kind of my question.
Right. I think fans are sort of past the steroids thing for better and for worse. I mean, they sort of understand, I think, at this point that the era was so dominated by pitchers like Clemens, like hitters like A-Rod and Bonds and so forth. So, you know, baseball, I think it's definitely the darkest age since, for example, the Black Sox scandal. The problem is just that everyone's being progressively and progressively more desensitized to it. And Clemens, again, by virtue of putting himself out there voluntarily, is just, you know, misguidedly putting himself in front of the fans' eyes when they don't necessarily even care about him anymore.
Okay. Who's excited about Brett Favre? Me.
You know what? It's whatever. You take all the dope out of professional sports. I mean, who's even going to sell the hot dogs? I mean, come on.
I mean, it can't be right.
Give me a break.
It can't be right. Well, Jimmy, what about you? Are you excited about Brett Favre?
No. I mean, it's just, you know, just some old. It's like, he's like the old guy in the club. It's like who wants to see some old guy?
He's
like,
so
like
good,
an old
though.
Dude.
Step light.
He's so good. He's
thank
so
you,
good.
Ruben.
Drinking Budweiser
and even
trying to
age,
get a swerve,
I mean,
on. No,
he
no
is
one
good.
Wants to
dude,
see that.
Dude,
no
he, dude, he ahead, is Adrian. Good. Dude, he is good. But they should change the fable from you know, the boy who cried wolf to the boy who cried Favre. I mean, he does it. He's done it 3 years in a row, and no one. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, it's almost like Andy Kaufman-esque. It's kind of like he's in on this, right? I mean, like, he knows what he's doing to everybody. We're still buying into it. But yeah, I mean, the other side of this is that he's actually really good. He had his best season, maybe ever. One of his best seasons last year, and so.
You all are such haters. If he can
he's
play,
the Hamlet of the NFL.
If,
I don't,
if he can
we,
play,
we would
what
love
is the,
for him to play till he's 89. But then don't flip flop and say, oh, you know, I might leave and come back. It's like we don't care about
see,
all
we
the
women
drama
are used to
music.
That. We yeah, women are used yeah. to that. Okay, it's all right with us.
Game,
I'll call you. Maybe
wall.
I'll call
exactly.
you. I'll call you when
I'm 90. Go for it.
That's why. See, you all just can't handle it when somebody flips the script on you.
It just got so cold in here.
Baby, I'm gonna call you.
Let me turn the air conditioner on. I resemble that remark.
That's what I'm talking about. Well, thank you, everybody. Jimmy Israel is a freelance journalist and author of the book, The Denzel Principle. He joined us from member station WCPN in Cleveland. Ruben Navarrete is a syndicated columnist with the Washington Post Writers Group. He also writes for CNN.com. He was with us from San Diego. Pablo Torre is a reporter for Sports Illustrated. He joined us from our studios in New York. And Arsalan Iftikhar was with us from Washington. He's the founder of TheMuslimGuy.com, a legal fellow for the Institute of Social Policy and Understanding and the author of a forthcoming book. Thank you so much.
Peace.
Thank you.
Yep.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more on Monday.